been studying about faith for many weeks now. We've been studying about how people were able to do the things they did because they had as a basis for their life faith in God. Faith is believing God. It's taking God at His word and acting upon the information that God gives you. When you accept information and act upon that information, it is information given by the Lord to you, then that is faith. And this morning we began a study in the 12th chapter of Hebrews that is a summation and an exhortation and a warning to those people in the Hebrew congregation who must now put into practice the things that Paul has taught them. They must themselves exercise faith. They must now run with patience the race that is set before them. As we've studied the Bible, we've understood and we've learned that people have served God acceptably for hundreds of years. We learned that Abel offered a more acceptable sacrifice. We've learned that Noah, moved with fear, built an ark. And that Abraham obeyed God and went out. Faith was the foundation of their service to God. Paul writes in chapter 11, verse 2, "For it, or by it, the elders received a good report." He also wrote that it is impossible to please God without faith. So when we look for a successful servant of God, who by his or her life has pleased God, we always find faith. And now Paul sums up these heroes of faith that he has listed and the accomplishments of faith. That is, the things they've done because they've had faith. Writing the statement, wherefore. And this word means, therefore, then. It means that now I'm going to tell you how we can apply the truth that I have taught you. It's a very strong affirmation of all that he has written earlier. And now he emphasizes that now you're going to see how this can become an important part of your life. These are Bible truths that I've taught you. Now you must, by using your faith, apply them in your life. It isn't enough to learn Bible truth. Bible truth must affect us. It must form a basis for the way we live our lives. Bible truth is not something we simply admire. It is not something we receive with excitement and then discard when boredom sets in. But it is principles. It is facts. These are the things then that form the very basis of why we do the things that we do. It gives us a basis for attempting things for God and for persevering in our lives as we live for God. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses. These people are called upon to look upon themselves as having all of these people as a massive cloud that is innumerable, faceless, and yet present. As we would look and see clouds surrounding us, then think of these clouds as being witnesses. It has to do with numbers. It has to do with intensity. Wherefore, seeing we are compassed about, we are surrounded with this cloud of witnesses. And of course, he's referring to all the people that he's mentioned in the 11th chapter and in other places of this book that he has written. These are the Old Testament elders. And these are the people who are without names, and yet their exploits are mentioned in the last verses of chapter 11. The word witness means really one who's had experience and one who remembers that experience. It has in it the idea of giving information and giving accurate information. So these people to whom Paul refers are people who had experiential knowledge. They were people who had important information. They were people who were faithful in giving their experiences, telling what happened, and having them recorded by divine inspiration in the Old Testament. We are surrounded by this cloud of faithful people who tell of their experiences with God. Seeing therefore that there is on every side of us a throng of witnesses. Now this doesn't necessarily present the idea of a sports arena where all of these witnesses are spectators, because if we'll look at what these people did that are recorded in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, they're not spectators. We should not look upon them as spectators in the work of God. They were vitally involved in the work of God. I don't think we should look at them as looking over the parapets of heaven. But this is figurative language. We are literally surrounded by people who have successfully served God, and faith was a basis of that successful service. By it they obtained a good report, and by it they pleased God. And we're surrounded literally by clouds of these people. We can look and have a witness and a testimony to God's faithfulness, to God's power, and a testimony to the help of God. We don't lack for example in what faith can be, what faith can do when it's used as the foundation of our lives. Wherefore, consider, and because of this, let us lay aside every weight. Let us cast off from ourselves the weight. And that doesn't necessarily have in it the idea of heaviness. It has more the idea of bulk or mass. Let us lay aside the bulky things, the massive things. Now, as we consider that in the idea of bulk or mass, then we understand how it might encumber. Try and carry not just heavy burdens, but things that are very massive. Things that are extremely bulky. This is the idea. Let us cast off those things that are bulky and encumbering, and the sin which does so easily beset us. Now the sin here is singular, and I know people are always talking about some particular besetting sin. It may not be of a particular problem to me, but it's a real problem with you, because all of us have a besetting sin. I don't think that's what Paul is saying at all. I think he is saying that every sin is besetting. That all sin is besetting. Now this word beset literally means standing well around, easily surrounding. So it has in it the idea that sin has every advantage. Now think of an individual standing in a particular place while he's surrounded by his enemies. And his enemies are on the higher ground while he stands here in the lower ground. So his enemies have all of the advantages. They can see every move that he makes. His enemies have the higher ground, and therefore they have tremendous advantage. And Paul is saying that sin as a principle, that sin has the advantage on all of us. Sin surrounds us. Sin watches us. And sin can move in on us because it has us surrounded. It doesn't come face to face with us and meet us on equal ground. We're playing on an uneven turf. We're playing by rules that are bent not toward our being victorious, but rules that are bent toward Satan being victorious. We're playing weak. That is, we're weak while he is strong. We're in a game that he knows better than any of us knows. We're on his turf. We're in his territory. And therefore, we are at a great disadvantage. So we need to lay aside the bulky mass that may be encumbering us. And we need to be careful of the sin which literally surrounds us. The sin that so readily entangles us. And I think these figures of speech intertwine. Now, Paul is saying we've got to run a race. We've got to run it patiently. And we've got mass. We've got things that are not only heavy, but they also are bulky. And like a long garment, sin surrounds us so that when we try to run swiftly, our feet entangle in this long flowing garment. So we must decide to lay aside this bulk that encumbers us, and we need to lay aside this heavy robe or garment that surrounds us and entangles us. So let us lay aside this weight. Let us lay aside the sin which has entangling properties and also that has us surrounded and makes us vulnerable. We're going to have to deal with these things. This is really what Paul is saying. And he realized that all of us are affected with these things and that they make us really ineffective. Most of us like to watch Western movies. I know I do. And a number of times you see people in the wagon train. The Indians are moving in on them and they've got to move swiftly. So they throw away all their furniture. They take all the extra weight off the wagon. They do everything they can to lighten the load. And then they head in a straight line, hoping they get into some terrain where the Indians can't surround them. Well, I suppose that's American for what Paul is talking about here. Lay aside the weight. Get rid of it. Airplanes oftentimes have to unload their cargo when they're in tumultuous circumstances. Ships have to unladen themselves in order to stay afloat. Paul is saying get rid of the mass because you're not going to move well with that mass that you're dealing with, and reduce your problems. Try to get rid of the things that entangle you and are a snare to you. Throw them off. You can't take them with you. You can't live your life effectively and victoriously with these things. And I don't know what they are, except they're encumbrances, and they also have to do with sin, or lead to sin, or so encumber us that we cannot serve effectively. And let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Now this is the message that Paul wanted these people to receive. Let us run with patience the race that is set before us. The word run is the word we get trek from. We use it to describe people in circumstances such as the jungle or the mountains, and they're trekking through the mountains. They're trekking through the jungles. And it has in it the idea of moving deliberately and speedily. Not necessarily running swiftly, but running steadily and running or moving thoughtfully with the idea of where you're going and what's going to happen to you. Let us run with patience. And there that word occurs again. We have seen it so many times. It has to do with the idea of staying behind after others have gone in order to do the things that need to be done. It means staying under the load. You know, most things that were moved in the days when Paul wrote this letter, they were moved with manpower. They did have some rather sophisticated engineering devices for lifting, block, tackle, fulcrums, and things of that nature, but most of the work was done by several people getting under a load and carrying it, sometimes rather long distances. So this word means that these people who were carrying the load, they had to stay under the load, that if you stayed under the load, then you were faithful, then you were patient. And the load that these people were carrying was the work of God, and they were the Hebrew congregation. Some of them were getting out from under the load. Some of them were saying, this is hard work, it's hot, and it's heavy, and I'm getting tired, so I'm just getting out from under the load, and the rest of you people can carry it. You know, if 12 people are carrying a load, and you distribute the weight properly, and they seem to be moving along rather well, but then the sun's hot, and the road's a little rough, and things get a little, you begin to feel a little badly, and so you say, well, if I leave, there'll be 11, and they can do well. A little while down the road, someone says, well, I'm tired also, and this other fellow's dropped out. If I drop out, there'll be 10 to carry this load. It's really not going to make any difference whether I'm there to help carry it or not. So following that mentality and that philosophy, a few others drop out from the load until finally 4 or 5 people are just very loaded down, and they're stumbling, and there's great weight upon them. And Paul is begging the people, don't get out from under the load. Run with patience. That is endurance. And I think that ought to be perhaps the word that's used rather than patient. Run with endurance. Walk steadily. Walk swiftly. Don't tarry. Walk with decision. And stay under the load. If I have any real advice to give our people this morning, it's stay under the load. Don't say, I'm not needed. Don't say, I don't count. Because you are needed and you do count. But if more and more people simply slip out from under the load because times are tough, just dumps more responsibility and more weight on people who are already struggling with all they can carry. Get under the load. Remain under the load. Let us run with patience the race that is set before us. That is, the road or raceway has been laid out. You know, we're not to simply decide, well, I believe I'll run to the northwest. I believe I'll circle around to the southeast. The course has already been predetermined by Almighty God, and we are to run it. It is set before us. Now, Paul's already given many examples of people who did this. Abraham did it. Job did it. You have all, James said, heard of the patience of Job. People who've ever done anything for God have done it. But there's someone that did it better than anyone else. And you know, if you want to achieve a particular goal that you have in life, and there's someone that has done it before, you ought to pick the man that's done it the best as your example. If you want to go into merchandising, pick the man that has succeeded. Pick Sam Walton as your example. I'm not saying as your spiritual example. I'm saying as your example in merchandising. If you want to pick a sports figure, pick the man who broke the records, who did the best. Because in it there'll be a great challenge. Now Paul goes to Jesus and writes in verse 2, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. The idea of looking means to look away from one's self, to look away from other things and concentrate on another. So Paul literally rebukes these people by saying, looking unto Jesus. He's saying you're looking at your own circumstances. You're evaluating yourself by your own problems. You're looking at things and saying this, that, and the other. What you need to do is quit looking at yourself, quit looking at all of these circumstances, and look unto Jesus. Why? First of all, He is our forerunner. He is the princely example, if you please. He is the one who has done it. The forerunner was a person who went into an area and scouted it out, came back and said, okay, let's go in and occupy. Jesus is our forerunner. He is the instigator. He is the starter of faith. Not only that, but He is the one who concludes things or completes things. One of our great problems is that we start a lot of things and rarely conclude them. Jesus started, became our forerunner. He became our initiator of things. As far as faith is concerned, He's the best example there is in the Bible and in the world and all of heaven of how a person starts by faith and ends by faith. Jesus completed what God gave Him to do. And therefore we need to look unto Jesus, who is our example. He is the author, the pioneer, the princely leader. He's our example. And finisher, the completer, the one who brings things to the goal. Looking unto our faith's princely leader, and the one who will bring completion, Jesus. And then Paul tells us some of the things that he endured, or the thing he endured and the circumstances of it, and how he completed what he started. And these people evidently were thinking about quitting. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, Paul said. Many of them, and he even said, as the custom or manner of some is. Some had already established the custom of not going to church. That, if you ask them, do you go to church? They would say, I used to. What someone has facetiously dubbed the used to wuzzers. I used to, I was one, so therefore, I'm not now, but I did, and I'm a used to wuzzer. Paul said, look at Jesus. He not only started something, He initiated it, but He completed it. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Now, He had problems, but Jesus looked beyond His problems. And that's just exactly what Paul has already said you need to do, looking unto, quit looking around, quit viewing your own circumstances. Do not abandon egocentric circumstances and attitudes and look unto Jesus. Now notice how He looked beyond even the suffering of the cross and the shame and the despicable embarrassment and humiliation that He endured, looking unto Jesus, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross. That is the gladness, the feeling of accomplishment, the feeling of having started and completed something. Jesus knew that on the other side of the cross there would be that gladness of heart that springs into the soul of those who complete their spiritual mission for God. Jesus realized that on the other side of the cross, on the other side of the grave, he could feel the joy and hear the pleasant statement of God the Father, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." This word "set before" statement means that it was plotted and planned out. God knew what Jesus was supposed to do, and Jesus knew what he was supposed to do. It was his flagged out, marked out route, and he endured it. And that word "endured" is the very same word that has "and let us run with patience." Jesus stayed under the load. He could have called angels, myriads of angels, but he didn't. He could have avoided the cross, but he would not have done God's will. He would not have effected eternal redemption had he done so, but he could have chosen not to have stayed under the load. He chose to stay under the load, but he was not looking at the load. He was looking at the joy and the gladness of having done his Father's will. And Paul is saying, you stay under the load, you stay under the burden, you endure so that you can accomplish what God has called you to do. Christ endured and completed the act of redemption. He knew the joy he would feel having completed the task that God had laid before him. But the Bible tells us he despised the shame. He treated it with contempt. Jesus looked upon the shame of the cross, that is, the disgrace and embarrassment and humiliation of it. Jesus looked at it with disdain and with contempt. He simply rose above it. He didn't let it settle in on him and drag him down. When they were falsely accusing him, dragging him from the garden, placing him in front of wicked judges who listened to the cries of the crowd, who stroked his back, who put crowns of thorns upon his head, who mocked him, all of these things, Jesus simply looked upon them as contemptible acts of sinful men. He didn't let it change his course. Despising the embarrassment, Jesus steadily endured the cross, caring nothing for its shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. And that signifies his work was done. Where is Jesus today? He is at the right hand of God. He is our high priest. He makes intercession for us. But Jesus did endure the cross. He suffered it. He died. He was buried. He rose again. And then at his resurrection in his glorified body, he went into the presence of God the Father and sat down as our representative in heaven. And that's where he is today. And this gives him unspeakable joy and fills him with gladness because he faithfully discharged and carried out all that God had given him to do. Paul says, "For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against self." Now he says, and this word "consider" doesn't mean just give a little bit of thought to it. It's the same word we get logistics from. So it has in it the idea of a critical look, of counting up, and even meditating upon the results. So consider him, that's Jesus, as a mathematician, as a computer programmer would consider all of the facts that must be put on these disks. Consider how he did what he did. Consider the glory that he has now. Consider all of these things. Who endured, and again, that means exactly the same thing as patience, to remain under, to endure, contradiction. And that word really means controversy. You know, sometimes we get the idea that Jesus was spat upon and he was cursed and ridiculed, and we think that of that as being the primary source of his shame, but it seems that Jesus simply was embarrassed and humiliated by the controversy that surrounded him. Now, Jesus became a controversial figure, and that was a part of his humiliation. There are those who seek controversy, who want to be controversial. And then there are people who do not. And Jesus was a man who did not want to be controversial. He did not want to have people speaking against him in controversy and in opposition to his work as he performed the will of God. Give constant, serious thought to him who steadily endured all that hostility from sinful men. Now notice, why? Why do these things? Why look unto Jesus? Why unload yourself of the bulk and the mass? Why get rid of the entangling clothing that keeps you from running effectively and efficiently? From the sin that surrounds you, the temptation to get out from under the load and not perform it, to get off the prescribed course, to get away from those the lifestyle that those people were involved in who lived successfully for God, and consider or specifically think about the attributes of Jesus Christ and how he did what he did. Why? What is the problem? If you don't do these things, what may happen to you? Paul said, lest you be wearied and faint in your mind. And the word weary here just means to get tired. Lest you be wearied and faint, which means to let go. Just turn loose. One translator put it this way, and I think it's adequate and accurate. Lest you be wearied and faint in your minds. This translator said, unless you get tired and give up. Thinking about your own physical body, thinking about how tired you are, how weary you are, because the work of God will wear you out. Anyone who says the work of God is sissy work to be done by people who have no endurance, who have no strength of character and body, has said an absurd and silly thing. The work of God will wear you out physically and mentally. And Paul even uses the word nous or mind here. It's just the same old syndrome that has affected God's people for hundreds of years and affects all of us, because you get tired. You get tired on the job that you work at. You're involved in it. You're caught up in it. It wears you. And when Sunday comes, the idea that hey, I'm tired, that's not a wrong assessment of yourself. That's not being weak to say, I'm worn out. I'm just exhausted. And Paul said, now if you quit looking at Jesus, you'll get to looking at your exhaustion, your weakness, and your tiredness, and you'll just throw it all away. And he's saying, look at Jesus, consider him, and don't just walk out from under the load. Don't just throw it away. And then he gives them a way to know whether you've carried the load as far as you ought to carry it. Whether you've gone that last mile. He writes, you have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. And Paul says, now, Jesus, our forerunner, he was stopped in his race by the shedding of blood. And that's the ultimate. When blood begins to run, then you can think about quitting. Whenever they start taking your blood, when they open your veins and arteries so that blood starts to run, then you can say, I've strived and I've worked and I've labored, and it's time to think about quitting. But Paul said, you people, you Hebrew congregation, you have not yet striven, which means to be in a competition, in a contest, to strive earnestly. You have not resisted, to stand in opposition against, actually means to get in battle, to go into battle. We're in battle, but you hadn't been shot yet. But when you get shot and blood begins to run, then you can think about quitting. We're in a battle, and when you feel the spear and you see the blood run, then you can think about going home. But we can't quit till the blood runs. Our musicians will come and sing our hymn of invitation. And as they prepare themselves, would you stand with me, please? If you're here this morning and if you've never trusted in Jesus Christ, you've never believed into Him, you're here and you've never received scriptural baptism, and you know that you need to, or you need to come and say, I have trusted in Christ, and I want to get under the load. I want to be a part of this congregation and serve God. Whatever your need, you come this morning as we sing.